All right, and we are live. Yes, we are. Yeah, Monday, August 8th, 2022, coming at you live from beautiful Belgrade, Serbia. We are going to look at today in the conflict in Ukraine. there are just a very small amount of information coming out right now. It's been very quiet. I mean, you have, rocket alerts issued from Kiev over different regions, but those don't mean very much. I don't understand the focus on like air raid or, alerts, because it'll be like the whole country. So I don't look at that. They issue those regularly. And it's been a series of days of a lot of artillery work on all the fronts with high casualties on Ukrainian side. And we're getting ready for big movements. It looks like, we look at mixed reports and just kind of what different people are saying at any given time. And it looks like both sides are building up, or both sides are recognizing that the Russians are building up in the Kherson area towards Mykolaiv. And that's going to be where some action is. And we know there's a lot of things that kind of have to pop off and be well in the works, like before winter. September should see a lot of big action, but yeah, it's this conflict, in my opinion, is not a daily event from a understanding it point of view. I haven't seen, it's been a couple of weeks since something has been the most important thing to happen, like in a given day. We're seeing more like important weeks, right? More than important days. Anyway, so we look a lot also, of course, at this Fourth Industrial Revolution stuff. And I got I have question about I get question about universal basic income, UBI and stuff like that. And there's always questions about like what is that all about, and because on the one hand, it's very divisive and people have their opinions about it. And those opinions are driven by certain narratives and facts and an understanding of human nature. And as is often the case, it boils down to whether you sort of have a view of, and this is totally separate from your religious perspective. So religious people can wind up on both sides of this. So this is, this is not about redemption. This is like maybe recognizing it on the first step to redemption type of thing, but there's nothing redeeming in and of itself, these differences among people and, how we respond, how we react to things like how we perceive things like UBI. And basically one issue is, human nature. Is human nature not going to work out well in combination with UBI? Like, are all the problems that it creates going to frustrate or implement, kind of exacerbate the worst aspects of human nature? Well, another bad aspect of human nature is like hoarding. UBI is kind of trying to be a thing that works against hoarding. But it involves like all the same problem mechanisms that human beings are like known for making. So there's like that kind of, kind of an anthropogenic pessimism as opposed to anthropic pessimism as opposed to anthropic optimism. Are human beings inherently like messed up? When is it human beings messed up and then you add technology and then it's human beings being messed up with technology? Or is it the technology is messing people up? Or is it unrelated? Is it like, is there something else? Is technology moving for these reasons and people are becoming messed up for, you know, those reasons over there, and they're all just kind of happening at the same time. And we're having the, we're confusing the chronology for causality or even a correlation. Maybe these are not correlated at all, right? I mean, they correlate, but maybe not at the stage of genesis, right? I'm going to open up the comments here. Sorry, let's see here. Open comments and questions on the live stream. There you go. And, you know, UBI, Universal Basic Income, is a very interesting thing because it's proposed by Milton Friedman at a time back in the 70s. And there was really a question about two directions to take things. The U.S. economy had gotten to a certain point by the 70s, and really it was, one of the questions was how to generate spending from consumers to kickstart economic growth and to speed up economic growth, so that economic growth, which depends on returns and sales, was not limited by people's ability to purchase. Also was this understanding that purchasing ability per person was starting to turn down a little bit by the late 70s, because that would be the overall trend onwards to this very day, is overall decreasing purchasing power based on income. So we're not talking about credit. And this is really, really where the question of UBI comes in. So whether to do UBI, and this would work as a direct government relationship between industry, government, and then citizens receiving UBI, okay? And then was the other proposal, which is for credit. So that's going to involve the financial industry, right? And then downstream from that, you're going to have, you know, the industry, productive industry, they kind of experience it almost the same, so they're fine with that. But an original conception of UBI actually cut out the financialists, okay? But it's going to put a lot of power in the hands of government. Now, if you have a government which you've had a decent experience with because it's been not in your face and out of your way, and it doesn't play games with the population, then you might think that this can work. There's just actually, it's very hard to untangle a lot of the confused, the contradictory positions of the historical post-Friedman movement-driven UBI stuff is completely hard to explain to people who aren't familiar. But if you see it as an example of a larger pattern, then it will make sense to you, like how they do, you know, the UBI thing. It will make sense to you as we break it down, why things turned out that way. So really, I got a letter from a listener, and I'll read the letter, and then we'll answer the question, okay? So I opposed the other day Schwab actually against the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Obviously, they're branding it. They own the label now, almost. But are they actually against it? Well, they're not against the version of things that they're promoting, but they're actually against the development of new technologies that are industrial related or industrial connected. They want to focus on the coercive administrative efficiency points and using algorithms to micromanage individual human beings. That's what the World Economic Forum, you know, that and the, you know, transhumanism and integration of like Johnny Mnemonic with the wet wire and all this stuff. All those experiments on those have led to catastrophe and death. Trying to put chips into monkey brains doesn't work. So the question is, how and what in science is investigated, and then what is finally developed into useful technologies, right? That's the question. And that is fundamental to where we are now, right? So just like you have UBI, if people understand, is a negative income tax. So instead of owing money at the end of the year, you receive, you know, and a lot of people have tax write-offs and different IRS categories or different tax categories that gets them out of, you know, that gets them out of what they really need, that gets them out of the issue, right? But with UBI, what you have is not challenging or taking for granted, right, that the impetus that you see around larger government growth and larger centralization is part of the way forward. So universal basic income is a very interesting thing because there's a lot of suppositions and context in any UBI scheme. Because in general, the issue that we're trying to resolve with UBI, okay, is as new technologies are implemented, they're inherently labor-saving. And labor-saving technologies do two things, okay? They're disinflationary, which means that the purchasing power of every dollar that you presently have increases a tremendous amount, right? But it also causes either higher unemployment or it reduces the total number of hours that the population has to work to produce the same thing. Then everything else is how do you divide that up? How do you have market incentives or use market mechanisms? In other words, how do you use mechanisms that are the most, where the person, the individual person involved in it experiences the simulation of the most decision-making and the most creativity, where they experience the simulation of the most decisions, right? In other words, they're going to have ownership over the outcome if they feel that they've decided things and that outcomes were not decided for them. Even if one can predict what those outcomes are likely to be, and that's the case with everybody, right? We talked about how people are concerned about track and trace, and people were concerned about these apps for COVID that governments wanted to put apps, and people were concerned about the tracking. And in a funny way, if you think about it, some of these things you're like, well, that's kind of weird because you would think these governments would just work through Google and because people's phones are tracking them. And then you realize that there's actually some of these security provisions that might be coming from some sovereign governments are at odds with this World Economic Forum stuff. They actually need to have, they want to be able to track the population and not rely on what Google says. Because Google represents not the interests of every sovereign country. And most countries are not all that sovereign, per se, in their practice, but there are these funny trends in this world that we live right now, where there's growing sovereign movements, all different types of countries. I mean, you saw, well, obviously in Pakistan with Khan, who was overthrown, but he was pushing in the direction of sovereignty. You have in El Salvador, right? Very strange government, right? Kind of a strange mixture of the left and the right. And you have a lot of this, a lot of these areas, obviously India, obviously Russia, right? So while UBI is obviously one very important tool that can be used to coerce and control populations and to basically create, you know, guidelines by which people have the privilege to have their, you know, digital monies refilled, like a UBI. Okay. And how that controls people is pretty evident. But what we aren't looking at typically is how actually the issue between credit and UBI was resolved some 45 years ago during the Nixon administration, and their relationship with the Federal Reserve and their relationship with the largest banks. And then looking at how does that work and what's the relationship between this and long-term social engineering. Nixon was not a typical, was not a conservative in the American sense. He was actually a socialist, but of the right, like a social fascist. And, you know, all the, a lot of recordings of the stuff that, you know, cause he had Watergate. So a lot of the recordings of his private office and stuff reveal that he saw himself at war with a Jewish dominated financial elite in the country. And, one of the interesting byproducts of this anyway was that he kept trying to find solutions that tied the government to industry in corporatist ways without having the financial arena sort of like manage the bandwidth between those relationships, or having the kind of financial arena dominate the outcomes of the relationship between government and industry. The relationship between government and industry kind of merging its functions is a social fascist thing. And so Nixon's ideas about how to address crises like healthcare was becoming a crisis and things like that. He looked for fascist solutions like the Kaiser Permanente HMO system that we have, the corporatist, you know, government co-private synergy, right? Now, as we have discussed, one of the problems with government co-public synergy, even though these solutions are corporatist and have been used historically mostly by what are called, you know, far-right regimes or authoritarian regimes backed by big industry, like in Europe in the 30s and 40s. The problem in that is that the actual activists around, you know, who have been surrounding the UBI question, especially in the last decade or two, really come out of the left. And in the UK, around, you know, labor, and it's not considered a socialist thing. So it's actually something that socialists support when they're trying to be reasonable. Does that make sense? Like when they're saying, okay, we're not going to overthrow this ruling class, but let's have a more reasonable relationship with them so that society can function despite their psychopathy. So obviously their psychopathy is going to be this cancer that we have to fight, but you know, we can't cut it out without killing ourselves, or that's a revolution, we're not in a position, or whatever the case may be. So how do you address it? UBI is very interesting because it has many similarities to other contemporary proposals. One of those, for example, we can compare it to is climate change or the environment. So environmental concerns typically were populist, and even some are, you know, a managerial class elite, like coming from academic institutions and the upwardly mobile educated class that starts to, on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, starts to have the extra time or ability to look at problems beyond their own nose. So I have a roof. I have a good job, roof over my head, you know, whatever, a mortgage, 2-car garage, marriage falling apart, or, you know, counseling, whatever it is. And that's normal life for people. And then they have this, okay, now I'm comfortable. The kids are in school. Now let me turn my attention to these abstract questions, like what's society going to look like in 50 years? And so you have that group of people. And altogether, you have a concern about degradation of the environment. We all know about gay frogs and stuff, and you know, aluminum being sprayed in the environment, and a lot of the industrial waste. And we know about the relationship between industrial waste, or the industrial waste that we consume as food, and cancer, or the relationship, all these things. And as we've discussed, there's been a tremendous push by the elites, the very same ones responsible for destroying the environment, to redirect and reorient all concerns about the environment into global warming, as if everything environmental was global warming and all bad things in the environment are the outcome of global warming. You see how they do that? Totally fake paradigm, totally false dichotomy. And likewise with UBI, where basically kind of like Farm Aid or something like this, you know, you're paid not to work. And that's kind of not really representing it correctly. I mean, the understanding is that there isn't work. If you had, and we've done this thought experiment before, because we're trying to understand what why people think certain things. People who aren't crazy, maniacal Schwabians, people who are just maybe, they're not socialists, they're anti-corporate. They see that all these big corporations actually could resolve issues of poverty without significantly changing their business model, without changing their profitability in a significant way, and a minimal amount of money would overcome a lot of poverty is sort of one of the facts that we wrestle with. But then you have, are the people that would propose solutions, implement them, because they're very much connected to these problems, aren't they just going to implement something in a way that doesn't work, or in a way that works towards their own ends? And that's very similar to the environment. So here you have, number one, ruling class destroy the environment, right? Number two, regular people kind of build a movement that gets people to focus on, hey, there's an environment to be concerned about. And then number three, then the same ruling class from one then co-opts that problem, redefines what's the cause and the solution of that problem, and then presents something that reinforces either the power of the ruling class or the power of its institutions, maybe towards the midterm or long term in terms of stability, right? Good. So UBI serves such a function. There's a dichotomy, just like with the environment, that most environmental activists, even though many of them have joined the cult of global warming, at the fundamentals, okay, they are people who are against the destruction of the planet. That's a good thing. They're against polluting the air and water. That's a good thing, right? And likewise with UBI, the impulse behind most of these activists pushing UBI on the ground is for greater freedom, not less. In terms of how we've defined more money equals more freedom and things like this, it's not really being what people don't really address in UBI. Well, it's addressed in UBI, but our understanding is often neglecting it. Besides that, automation is leading in this way. I'm going to propose how to understand where UBI could make sense and why, generally speaking, UBI is a very good idea in very limited circumstances and a very bad idea as your, let's say, your strategy, as your framing strategy for the fourth industrial revolution, and I'll explain why. Okay. In any given industry, okay, our economic lives and why things have a price for things is effectively, you know, even removing profit margins, okay, the price for things is in some way, whether distorted or not, a reflection of scarcity. It's very hard to get someone to buy something that they already have, unless you make them think that they don't have it. Like self-respect, youth, beauty, all these things that you have or have some of left because you're still alive, they make you think you have none. So they obviously are attacking you psychologically. We know about marketing in the Bernaysian Revolution. We understand that. But generally, people don't want things that they already have. But sometimes if things are given away, then people might hoard it because they're not sure that it's always going to be like that. So if something is given away, people might hoard it. And then they're like, I have extras and then I'll sell it later once all this free stuff is gone. So people don't really have confidence in too much of a good thing. It leads to runs. We're talking about problems that arise in kind of looking at UBI. So what they want to do with UBI is obviously tie it to your consumption. And even though this word means different things to different people, the you will own nothing, eat the bugs, and be happy people are pushing UBI, right? And just like how they push the fourth industrial revolution and you're against it because they're for it, they're pushing UBI and maybe you're against it because they're for it. Well, there's reasons that are to be against it that are smart, but there are areas where it works that could be applied. But the question is always cui bono and who's applying it? Obviously, if we're talking about the general trend right now being towards greater decentralization, technologies leading towards greater decentralization is the trend. And they want to create social and political dynamics in place now so that they can control populations in a post-labor or in a transition to post-labor society. That's still another 50 to 100 years, by the way, that human beings are not necessary in any of the kind of jobs that you think about today. So there had been this misunderstanding promoted primarily by the free, you know, actually a lot of people from all over promoted this myth that labor-saving technologies created more jobs, not less. And it's just false. It's actually textually false. It's logically false, prima facie. And the reason that they get away with saying it is because there are moments in time where that's not the case. Just like in physics where you have an open system or a closed system. Obviously, if you're looking at an open system and you're looking at an instantiation within an open system, you can find areas where for periods of time or for kind of bubbles that emerge, not economic bubbles, but just the foam of the interaction of these processes can create in the open system permutations that look like more jobs are being created. For example, increasing automation and heavy reliance on certain information technologies or computers to make those things might, for a short period of time, create new jobs in computer programming for the AI computer-aided system, okay? But what happens over time is then those processes become automated. So even though it continues, the argument is not being made that, well, people keep getting freed up to do more things, so that, you know, tends to have a downward push on wages, which tends to make hiring people more affordable, which tends to lead towards higher employment. This is not the dynamic that you're talking about towards the zero point, and the zero point being where everything is automated. So even though between here and on the way to the zero point, if you looked at the big graph, you can see the overall trend towards unemployment, right, or underemployment. So that should be sloping down in your mind's eye, like looking at a Cartesian kind of thing, XY graph, right? It should be going down, right? The employment should be going down. Unemployment should be going up. Employment should be going down. The problem, though, is that the purchasing power of the money you have as an underemployed person is very high now. Is very high. Because it's the opposite of, well, it's not the opposite, but it cuts in the other direction as inflation. It's deflationary, but maybe more correctly, disinflationary. Okay. Labor-saving technology leads towards unemployment in the final analysis, point blank, period. Now, in a society of superabundance, okay, listen to this. In a society of in a gift economy, in a society that's overcome a lot of scarcity, you have different factors. But you're going to be able to, people are going to be able to live and do stuff at a very low cost to no cost, you know, in the, not no cost, but it's such a low cost. Okay. Of course, it can be calculated and needs to be accounted for. And the difference between zero and very low is infinite, because anything above zero is infinitely greater, in fact. So that's a huge error to make between, I don't want to make that error, but it is true that ultimately, by the thought experiment, all things could be automated. Now, the things that people do after everything is automated could be entirely subsidized, or, you know, you're talking about, for example, what would people do? Well, in general, if we listen to Harari or people like this, these psychopaths think that people just want entertainment all the time. Okay. But, and maybe that's true for some number, maybe a lot of people, I don't know. I mean, obviously people will be products of environments that also shape them, and culture is a big part of this too. So it's questionable to what extent he's talking about a culture where people work 50 hours a week and are just so exhausted by the time that they're done working that they have no room for any other ambition, dream, hope, interest, hobby, or whatever, and they just want to decompress and play video games or whatever, okay? Whatever it is that Harari's saying, to that the government or whatever, the corporation that controls, you know, the your new overlords just want to entertain you. And you're so dumb that that'll be easy. That would be the nice route, and then the mean route is extermination of the useless eaters. What looks like how they want to arrange UBI is to connect the ability to access UBI to things like vaccination status or your you know, biometric stuff, and to what extent that you follow this. So if you read the COVID-19 book, the blue book that we talk about so much, and you read, if you understand how to read between the lines and understand the logic of what's being said, if you understand, like we talk about in general, like for example, an economic crash where then you have high unemployment, right, does not inspire investment into automation. No. Unlike how the book claims, okay, no. Because then wages are so low that it makes more sense to hire people today than to invest in labor-saving technologies when any investment is not realized until later. And why would you do that in a market environment of the lowest possible wages? In fact, it's wage inflation or higher wages that drive investment into labor-saving technology. Just like with energy, right? It's like when the cost, it's like when that crude goes over, you know, $90 or $100 a barrel, and then you get all this excitement in the, you know, shale or a fracking, right? Because it's only worthwhile in relation to the value of the other. So these are all the ideas that we need to kind of keep in mind when we talk about UBI, right? The reality of governments putting conditions on UBI that tend towards slavery or tend towards some kind of corporate madness. And then you have over somewhere else real existing things that will have to be sorted. And so even though it's true that all in the final analysis, labor-saving technologies save everyone from having to do labor, like that's literally what we're talking about. So the idea that this can create new jobs is mentally retarded. It's like you're reading 2 plus 2, and when you see the plus sign, you're like, subtract? Divide? No, motherfucker, add. Subtract? No, add. Divide? Say divide one more time. You know, because it says add. It doesn't get more clear than that. Labor-saving technologies are labor-saving technologies. And labor-saving is the definition of economical. In other words, the definition of a growing economy means things are getting cheaper, or conversely, your dollar goes a lot farther. A lot farther. If you just had, okay, a growing economy, meaning the labor-saving technologies are expanding, you would see some areas that are needed, right? New work and repairing these robots. But then they're going to invent robots that fix the robots. Do you see how that works? And overall, even though it creates new jobs in certain areas, the overall number of people employed, or that rather speaking more correctly, the number of hours to work shared within the population, the number of hours necessary for society to work at the present level goes down. Okay. So then why wouldn't you just let things be? Why wouldn't you just let things be? And then even though people are underemployed, and even though their number of hours that they can work has dropped from, you know, 50, 60 hours a week down to 15 or 20, okay, now you have three people that can share for a 45-hour work week. Each person only works 15 hours a week. But the value of that money that they've made is equivalent to a 45-hour work week from simply a number of years ago. That's what a growing economy means. So a lot of the UBI stuff is a problem because it takes for granted, number one, that there's going to be a type of a central bank or a profit-motivated bank that has the ability to actually produce currency, which is almost the opposite of a central bank in many ways. There's many different definitions of that's a problem that we have. We talk about private bank, central bank, and we mean different things by them. Different people actually mean different things by this, just like with the word liberal. And you probably found that in your readings. Like, oh, I thought that was a private, oh, that's a central bank? Oh, is it, right? It's like, is a private bank a central bank, the Federal Reserve? But when you look at what happened in the U.S., they combined a lot of things that, you know, wouldn't have been done elsewhere. And what they did in the U.S. is we're not just talking about the consumerism and all of this, but at this junction point, this is actually an inflection point in the 70s, and the things that happened in the Nixon administration would kind of shape the outcome for decades to come. Looking at, they basically said, we're not going to do UBI because it didn't really plug in the financial, okay? You need that, you just have credit. And then we have the credit crisis, that, you know, personal credit debt is very high. But moving forward, when you get towards the zero point, think about from the point of view, if you're a company that wants to expand or remain competitive, you have a great, there's a great contradiction. There is a great dilemma, which is that the more that you invest into new technologies, long term or even shortly, you dry up, your returns dry up. the returns are diminishing. New technologies, applied new productive labor-saving technologies, do weird things to money and the returns on your investment. You're going to make a lot of other people wealthy at the same time. And even though, for example, this investment won't pay off in terms of the borrower paying you back, but rather, overall, this practice will lead towards all the money in your possession growing in value, growing in purchasing power. And that's a very difficult thing to articulate, to get going, to circulate as an idea. And it also doesn't work for the financialists who rule, who are, you know, one of the important powers in the U.S. There is a conflict, but they're a very important power. And so the reason that the UBI is very similar to stupid solutions proposed by labor unions as federal legislation to increase wages. Obviously, they don't have, you know, these employee organizations, the collective bargaining organizations, and they're very integrated Democrat Party, but they, that angle of it doesn't have the ability to regulate inflation. And so they're always trying to tie salaries to inflation. Which is a crisis way of dealing with something. Really, what you would want to have is the labor-saving technologies result in greater purchasing power. And for whatever reason, there's this thinking that everyone that works has to work full time, and then you're going to have people that don't work at all and receive a UBI. And then you have this thought that, well, what if you put the UBI as a supplement to salaries? But then what you're really saying there is, why not you just eliminate the fucking income tax for employees? Do you see how obvious certain solutions are? Like the column A, column B stuff, like let's have half of people working 40 hours, half of people working 0 hours, take the people working 0 hours and pay them not to work, and then the people working 40 hours, now that you've printed money to give to people that aren't working, now you've debased the currency on people who are working, so now they have an extra tax on top of the hassle of working 40, 50 hours a week. And the natural way, or the sort of organic way in terms of how people make decisions and stuff, that you would get an outcome without all of this social engineering would just be that you had the market functions would actually result in people working fewer hours, unemployment going down, but the number of hours worked by everybody also going down overall. At any given time, in a very small case, in certain industries or connected to certain areas of the economy, and if it's done at a very local level, you could have a UBI. You could have a UBI system but it should always be recognized as a stopgap, a transition, and not some great vision for the future or like a solution to these things. It's actually just a stopgap. It can help because in reality, you don't have people just the market signals don't exist in the raw. You live in a corporatist system. It's not a market system. You don't get response to signals, and people don't behave necessarily. Well, people are going to behave in the way that the game is set up and not in response to the dynamics that we've explained. And the way that it's set up is with the present system is that no one is really going to work less hours. They're just going to feel like they're, if they see that they're purchasing power is going up, it might even inspire them to work more. Okay, so you can't force people to give up half their hours as a charity so that other people don't have to be on welfare. Does that make sense? Or UBI? A lot of the arguments used to justify UBI are the same arguments used to justify welfare, and they're all pretty dumb arguments long term. I mean, again, they're all fine when we talk about stopgap, short term, you know, things to get you from A to B, but it's not the vision for the future. In fact, it doesn't even make sense unless you're trying to create a tax farm without taxes. So then you just have a bunch of useless eaters from the point of view of government or corporation. Unless we have government, which is the embodiment of people. And that obviously occurs at a lower level. There's a lot of reasons, not just geographic or spatial, but psychological and your relationships of affinity and responsibility. Local politics is much more manageable and able to keep on target and accountable than, you know, larger and larger scale. The larger the scale it is, the greater disconnect between people's lived lives and the possible solutions that we can imagine are limited by that disparity in representation, not just in distance. We're not just talking about all the way in Washington, but we're just talking about in the abstract, the power dynamics and the number of people who's, you know, being represented. The greater number of people being represented by any one representative leads to an overall decrease in the level of representation. So, you know, there had been a lot of different approaches to things like UBI. Its roots are in the social credit movement, SoCred, the Green Shirt Kibble Kif. This was a pseudo or proto-fascist organization, mostly fed into the British Union of Fascists by the 30s after being in the New Party. A lot of the activists, that would have been around Oswald Mosley. But prior to the creation of the New Party, and when Oswald Mosley was himself still a Marxist-Leninist in the Labour Party fighting against MacDonald and trying to get people like George Orwell and other Trotskyite kind of weird thing going on at this time to reinvigorate the Labour Party in a communist direction before he became the leader of the British Union of Fascists, Sir Oswald Mosley. While he was studying Leninism and was promoting that the Labour Party become a Leninist vanguard party to seize power in England, the Green Shirt movement of the small entrepreneur crafts and tradesmen were coming up with a UBI system based upon what was called the A plus B theorem. And the A plus B theorem was basically looking at the receipts of expenditures of a company and those things that they spent on that didn't go back into productive parts of their own industry that were, even though they were productive, they were helping other industries, upstream, downstream. You see what I'm saying? And yet some of the tax burden and the cost were on them, even though they're part of an overall economic growth, which their immediate, you know, profits and returns aren't fully reflected in. Does that make sense? Because of this, and they're saying that this sort of leakage, right, from their cost of doing business is actually pushing inflation. It's actually not correct, but you can understand the thinking and what was behind it in the social credit, SoCred movement, Kibble Kip. It was like a they were very much like in that transition when the between sort of like a youth camping organization, nature, like it was going to be like the Boy Scouts or the YMCA, kind of into the brown shirts and the SA, like a Nazi organization type of thing. The green shirts. Yeah, like the blue shirts, the black shirts, the brown shirts. And in England, before the BUF black shirts, you had the green shirts. All right. So the history of UBI, just so people understand, is a social democratic / fascist, social fascist solution to things. I don't say that to color it, that those are not moral descriptive terms, by the way. Those are just facts. Maybe they're good ideas. You see what I'm saying? But I'm just telling you as a fact where these ideas come from. Then it had been talked about a lot. You see, American conservatism changed in the 80s under the influence of Friedmanism, Reagan, culture, Thatcher, and that's all good. But what got really nasty was the way that people, you can see in the fixation on, you know, the, well, we saw it later in the 90s, technically 90s with Baywatch, but all that Baywatch stuff was just the 90s, the 80s bleeding out into the early 90s, right? That wasn't really 90s. Baywatch isn't really 90s, if you think about it. Baywatch is really 80s. And that kind of whole thing, the blonde, the Ferrari, that whole kind of, you know, Miami Vice, Secret to My Success, Wall Street, all these kind of movies, this culture was in that direction. American conservatives in the 1950s, you know, so-called eggheads and policy wonks and also just regular people, voters and stuff, people who had been in World War II and worked in organizations, worked in institutions, and then out of world, maybe they were an engineer. We're not talking about grunts. We're talking about people that were involved in the planning and strategic stuff in the infrastructure of the military. After World War II, they go on to become managers and, you know, engineers and in industries, okay? And they look at maybe in some ways some of the lack of discipline or chaos and or between these organizations, financial and market, as compared to the order and discipline in the military. So you can see this kind of coming together of things in America. And in America, they didn't have this idea that government was bad or that markets solve everything among conservatives in the 50s, okay? The issues were cultural. And obviously, the cultural issues, they actually, government was not viewed as the problem. Obviously, people understood about bureaucracies, but they also understood about societies of scale, and societies of scale need solutions of scale. At least that's what you would imagine. And that's how people saw things, because you have large factories producing cars, and you have large distribution networks, large coordinated supply line chains, and the highway system, and the trucks, and the dispatchers, and the ports, right? That's all societies of scale. So you're going to have political structures that mirror and reflect and represent those large bureaucratic structures of scale, right? Yes. So we understand that. And in the 50s, this wasn't seen as like the problem in and of itself, right? In fact, it wasn't even seen as a problem per se. And maybe at that time it wasn't. But the point is that these engineers and managers and stuff looked at things like supply line, distribution costs, and in many times it actually does just make sense to cut a check to people, right? To cut a check to people. Give people money. And, you know, after all, even what's very interesting is that we attack these banks, the main Federal Reserve, for generating, for emitting dollars, debasing the currency, and we see this upwards redistribution of wealth, and we're against it, and then we see the results of that on society, the upwards redistribution of wealth, and you see people, and then they're clamoring for UBI, and we're against that. So the problem, of course, is understanding that all of those are problems, and one is a reaction to another imposed problem. And maybe that proposed reaction to that problem solves some aspects of that problem, and it does appear to. The issue is that the same elites understand that, and then they're going to use a proposed alternate to the present system, right, to carry forward their own power regime. Because if in the 70s, if the question was, you know, whether to have the direct relationship between government and industry and basically start to basically work to, you have the government collects taxes from all of the companies, and each of the companies is pursuing certain areas of the economy, certain areas of industry, certain areas of technology. And some of those are going to fluctuate. Some breakthroughs are going to happen in some industries scientifically or in the productive, you know, machinery breakthroughs and efficiencies before others. By nature, these are distributed unevenly, and then they begin to interact, and then you start to see, I mean, it's part of an overall rise, but that doesn't rise evenly. So the government takes all the tax revenues from these companies, and then it can offset differences in hours work, wages, salaries, and things like that without having a single credit card debt. So the credit card solution to the same problem was introduced in the 70s. Okay, now, and it was known then that they were kind of kicking the can down the road, and we're kind of reaching that point in the road right now where that can sit. And we can't really kick it again because that's just another financial bubble. So then you're looking at maybe UBI. So I'm helping to kind of set up to explain the thinking and how these things kind of all work together. All right. Now, in answer to this letter, in the part in the letter, it's written to me, quote, there's also been in the past few years grown up a kind of academic industry in piloting UBI, which are nearly always not really universal, with certain groups targeted, most of which do track spending in an effort to prove that people do spend it on good things, and which, of course, are time limited. There is a reality that this does not prove very much at all, since the people receiving money know that it will end at some point and that their spending is tracked. So their behavior will be shaped by those conditions, right? There was the Soros NGOs are going, well, they have sort of a poverty pimp activist in every city, and they're constantly falsely representing themselves as representing a constituency to the city councils who actually are fucking elected and do have constituencies. So imagine you're an individual and you're claiming to represent a constituency. No one elected you. You're just a Sorosian NGO that claims to represent a problem, not people, but a problem associated with people in your opinion. So then they come at the city councils and they, for example, my mom was telling me, cause she's in New Mexico, in a town and in a city, and they were like, these people, and they're from the same place, but they're just connected to this, you know, vast network, and they, you know, get their phone calls and their emails about what they're pushing. Before it was, you know, the eight can't wait. We have to push these eight things to abolish or to defund the police. That didn't go anywhere. And then this one, the latest one on this from this group was, let's set up, we're going to pick 1,000 people from the city, and we're going to give them all this amount of UBI, and they're going to be picked at random, but the NGO is going to pick them. Oh, so it's not going to be your friends and people that you've, okay, and then they're going to track their spending. It's just so dumb. It's so divisive. The mayor said, this is so dumb, guys, like, if you ever want to have people accept UBI or do or be supportive of UBI, you don't give it to a small number of people for a short period of time. That the reaction to that's gonna be so fucking negative. Just so dumb. All right. So quote, there is a reality that this does not prove very much at all, since the people receiving the money know that it will end at some point. Yeah. Goes on. There's also the question of whether UBI is a right based on all that's been or is being expropriated by colonialism and capitalism. That's just about whether the wealth in a given society really belongs to that society, whether it was appropriated elsewhere. I won't get into that. You can't untangle that. I mean, I know the Maoists like try to do that, and their arguments are very dumb because they think that the price that people pay in the U.S. is the expropriated labor of the person in the third world. They don't look at all the labor value added middlemen games that occur. That it's not doesn't work out that way at all remotely. And then the salaries earned in the country where the thing is made, even though those salaries couldn't buy very much here, they buy a lot more over where they're given. So it's just the whole thing is misrepresented. So I won't talk about that. Or if whether this is essentially welfare for those chucked out of jobs by automation. Yeah, that's more what this is, more what UBI is all about, right? Because remember when Andrew Yang was running, that's who brought back his work in terms of this, what he was doing, multiple levels, take away some Trump voters, get your $1,000 bag of cash using the Pepe memes, a lot of the alt-right kind of stuff behind Yang Gang and stuff like this. Try to, you know, get even like Nozball Gang and different people, different mimetic tropes and fronts to kind of, you know, how the Redditors work. So all that was UBI and the Yang campaign. And Yang was speaking in terms of what is going to happen when the Silicon Valley, by the way, that's who was behind him, and corrupt elements of SEIU, which is most leading elements. He was like Andy Stern. This is like before everyone now, even before Mary Kay Henry at SEIU. Andy Stern. So all the people are corporatist Democrats, union hacks. And that's who Andrew Yang is speaking to and coming from and representing Silicon Valley. And he's saying, you know, Tesla is going to have these self-driving trucks and truck drivers are going to be hit first and truck drivers are going to be out of work. Okay. And then he starts talking about Bismarck's anti-socialist legislation and how we need to be like Bismarck and implement from a corporatist or Bismarckian perspective how to do things to make guarantees on wages and salaries so that there is not a socialist uprising that takes what it wants in on its own terms. That's why Yang made constant remark and allusion to Bismarck's anti-socialist legislation. So if you think UBI is socialist and you're on the left, and you're on the left for humanist reasons and because you want, you know, power to be democratized and you want the elites to disappear, right? And you want a more egalitarian society, people have more freedom and without these corporations telling you how to live, and you're a socialist, you are being supportive of UBI is probably incoherent if you really think it through, because it's just going to give the way that they're proposed and arranged is not at all towards the solutions that you want to see. Now, we're not even debating whether it could work the way you want. Openly, the people promoting UBI at the top do not want the, you know, human-driven outcomes that you as a humanist or a socialist desire. Does that make sense? Rather, I'm not saying that there is an easy solution to this. I don't think that we just get behind legislation 25-5 and call your senator or whatever. Okay, I'm not suggesting that this is easy. I know that this is a large corporatist system that we can't just decide that we are market fundamentalist when it applies to the poor or when it applies to the needy. And I don't think that markets provide any solutions in and of themselves. I just look at what are the, you have many different ways to get to arrive at similar outcomes. And the ones that people experience as least repressive are the ones that people experience as being the outcome of their own decisions. that's an important mechanism to overcome the dichotomy of entitlement. And it's better even to err on the side of self-responsibility over general victimization as an operating framework. We're talking about the welfare and well-being of everyday people. Obviously, our emotions and our psychology is very important because that's how we really determine things. I know this sounds strange, but 10,000 years ago, you could have a lot less but experience more satisfaction because, number one, that's all that's available, so you don't have this fear of missing out and you don't have this keeping up with the Joneses. So our sense, a relative sense of poverty, I'm not talking about like fucking maggots and crust around your eyes with fucking flies and shit. I'm not talking about starvation or famine. Just what is kind of considered poverty, but you look and all these kids are running around, getting calories, going to school. That's fine. And when you compare, it's only when we're aware in the abstract that there's these other people doing more, doing better, because we're so focused on what other people are doing. There's a healthy side to this, by the way, because obviously such disparities in wealth and power lead to disastrous outcomes for everybody. So we are kind of looking at the problem of the upward redistribution of wealth. Does that make sense? So, in a discussion about UBI, you know, it's just, it can get confused because there are anarchists and socialists or communists who've gone kind of on a reformist path and are promoting this Schwabian World Economic Forum talking point of a UBI without really realizing what it's really, what, how it would be expressed. And they're kind of even taking aspects of, you know, anarchist theory to support this. And they're looking at decolonial and they're looking at the development of pre-statist societies. And they're saying that's like they did UBI, like these ancient tribes did UBI. And like, no, not really. It was just, they were at such a level of development and had such a, even though you had elders and some kind of crude division of labor during this process of, you know, primitive labor, primitive capital accumulation, primitive accumulation of capital, even though you had different roles and different jobs in society, everyone, you had maybe only four or five or six families, you know, that make a tribe and stuff like that. And they kind of all know each other and everyone kind of knows what some other people are doing. And in a sense, it's kind of like that problem being from a small town and everyone has, you know, their nose up your ass. But the flip side of that is that there is a kind of unspoken, like, oh, I have extra, have some, because it's like your neighbor. Oh, I have two bowls of rice, have my bowl of rice. I mean, at that very fundamental, crude level, and someone, you know, that's no big deal. But that's not the same thing as UBI. UBI is so, it's stupid to talk about, in my view, just talking about if words should have meanings, we should use language a certain way. If you want to sell UBI today to the left, of course you're going to make references to ancient societies, but if you really define UBI for what it is, it's only possible in a Fordist, Taylorist, industrial society of scale. And those are all the problems with UBI. It's trying to connect the solutions, the outcomes of this paradigm. The next paradigm is obviously moving decentralization with things like 3D printing, and there are larger events going on geopolitically that weren't necessarily the outcome of just the technological developments in the raw, but the geopolitical, but the effect of these economic developments on the geopolitical balance of powers has generated this supply line issue, which can actually expedite and jumpstart a lot of 3D printing stuff, but it's not going to happen as an initiative of the elite. No matter how much they talk about it, that's so much of them talking about things that you're already doing so that you might even fucking think that you're doing it because they talked about it or that you're following the orders that they gave. So a lot of this stuff is just them running in front of the crowd and yelling, "Follow me." But it's the crowd, it's the people that were determining that direction. They just find where the people are. They look at the direction things are going. They run in front of it, and then they try to make you think that this is their long-term plan. This is their conspiracy. Even they worked this all out. And when you're doing it, you're just following them. There's so many different dimensions to this. I think it's difficult to eclectically pick and choose from practices of ancient people, different people in the past. You're talking about, even though today a lot of scarcity is driven by this economic reality that there's no, in human aims, it's hard to distinguish how, economic doesn't really translate the difference. Economic life doesn't really translate the difference between wants and needs. So your needs and your wants are almost the same thing in terms of the economy, in terms of how markets respond to human activity. It doesn't really make a difference why you want something or need or why you're after something. It's just that you're after it. You're in pursuit of it, whatever your reasons are. So we don't even have to assume that people are rational or they're rational calculators or they're constantly doing game theory correctly or gaming each other correctly. You know, they may be gaming each other wrongly. You know, there's all kinds of notions that people have that guide their activity, not, rational calculators. So there's a lot of elements to this to unpack, but it's certainly incorrect to think about how in an ancient tribe that had 300 people that nobody starved. That's not at all the same thing. UBI implies a society of great scale. But see, the time to have done UBI would have been 50 years ago, but we did credit instead of UBI. But the endpoint that we're approaching isn't solved either by UBI nor by credit. Do you see what I'm saying? So it was sort of like an either or some kind of mix of both, because you could have some like welfare and safety net, but what the U.S. really had was personal debt. Like you're unemployed. Oh my God, I'm 15,000 in credit card, or I'm 50,000 in credit card debt. I've been unemployed for 2 years. You see? People, not me. No, I never even had a credit card. So I'm just saying how people are. So, much of the letter is this person's experience as an activist around UBI and people. After UBI, you have, of course, once a society is productive enough, there are many things which just become unnoticeable, or of course they can be calculated, but they're so incidental. And even in accumulated to the, volume of hundreds of millions or billions of people, just as, a few cents per person type of thing. And we make a lot of errors in thinking about UBI this way. Like a society, there are different people in society and there are different needs that people need from society or from life. Okay. And it's completely, of course, fine if you're talking about a single parent, a single mother, and has children, and you're basically talking about welfare. And this is fine. I mean, we're just talking about on the face of it. Obviously, you can incentivize divorce this way. Depends on, in the U.S. we have really laws inherited from slavery times. We have laws inherited from the manuals on plantation management about separating husbands from the families and things like that. How families operate. In other words, it's ideal sometimes if the man is from a different plantation and has different owners than the woman and the children. It's slave owners would arrange and off days and sometimes even passage for a man to visit that family. Some slaves received money. I know this is weird. Okay. There are many slaves received money. Sometimes this was money that was not universal, but a private money like a strip. And many plantations had networks of plantations and worked as a big company town. They issued, you know, scripts or type of currency and all types of things like this. In slavery, you have the owner of the slaves owns all of them. So there's no taxes to be, it's 100% tax, okay, slaves. In fact, you can almost look at slavery and freedom not as absolutes, but as a bandwidth that goes through like a grayscale. And, you know, over 70, 80% taxation is slavery, and under 15 or 10% taxation is like freedom, right? Just talking about in reality and how you might talk about this conceptually. So, you know, a lot of slaves received some money. They maybe 5% of the value that they were producing for the owner, they got, and it made more sense. Listen, it made more sense. It was more efficient, and there was more satisfaction for the slave that they made the personal decision about what to do with this very small amount of coinage that they would receive. They could save it. They could buy this or not buy that. And it was much more efficient than a plantation owner determining which what each slave should want or could want or could need or should need. It's just much more efficient that the person who has the wants and needs is given a very small amount of money and then forced to make decisions about how to allocate that. Much more efficient. Then not having enough of the things that they need, then the argument by friends or to themselves can be made, well, you weren't wise with it. You spent, look at last week, you bought this and that was dumb. You could have bought a better X, but instead you bought a stupid Y last week. So it personalizes these things. This is a very well-known psychological function that the elites use in managing societies of scale, but it also collides kind of harmoniously with a very basic human instinct. And so we've reached another contradiction in human organization. Okay. That's the very key to the liberal system is your feeling of freedom. They're very different from communism and fascism. I'm not saying that people in fascist or communist societies in their personal lives, especially if they had no interest in politics and their work was important enough, like a technical, many people experience a lot of freedom in their personal lives, by the way, in all types of regimes, just to be clear. But we're talking about entrepreneurial freedom and political freedom and structures that allow for both. So, UBI was a solution proposed, and it would have worked a very different way 50 years ago. What the thought we didn't finish was that in the Blue Book, on the COVID-19 book, when they talk about UBI and when they talk about the formulas, or what I interrupted myself in addition was in talking about how they're trying to say that a collapsed economy would lead towards investment into automation, which is completely false. For the reasons we explained, because the unemployed people, their wages are less, it makes more sense to hire them than, okay. The reality is that they know, this is going to take a dark turn. Their calculation and their implied formula make zero sense unless the overall population is declining. Numerically declining population is the only aspect of this calculation that you could add that it makes sense that you would have a shortage of that you would have a collapse in the economy that simultaneously inspired investment into labor-saving technology. To have both of those at the same time would mean that the collapse was connected to or produced or was caused by a population collapse. Because that's the only thing that could really drive wages up or have an inflationary push on wages in the context of an economic collapse. I think that's on page 40 or 41. I mean, we went through it about a year ago, and we just were flabbergasted to find the genocide written in the equations in the COVID-19 Great Reset book, the Klaus Schwab book. So those are more on UBI. We always come back to UBI. I hope this had some utility for you. You can understand some of the history of UBI. You can see that there had been genuine pushes for UBI. Originally, it was a conservative middle-class movement of entrepreneurs and small business and crafts and tradesmen who wanted social credit to make up for costs that they incurred that actually benefited monopoly tendencies of larger companies to be reimbursed on those as a hedge against, or to mitigate rather, inflation. The green shirts, kibble kift. Then it was introduced, it had been constantly introduced in small corners ever since World War II. I mean, just to understand, the military industrial complex is like a UBI scheme. That's why we talked about corporate thinking and people who'd been in the military and in the, you know, not the grunts, but people who'd been in the military in World War II, involved in management, logistics, supply line, technology, communications, engineering. And their experience in the corporate world in the 50s and 60s afterwards. Government had a high amount of credibility at this time. And as an institution, it doesn't mean that people looked for government to solve problems. It just meant that the government was not viewed as being as corrupt as it is today. That's a fact. That's not my impression. I had to write about this. Oh, because I'm being accused of undermining American faith in institutions. See how the abusive corporate fascists do that to me. This is not about me, but just I can share with you conjecture, sort of anecdata. Like, they've undermined their credibility by the things they're doing. We talk about those things, and we're the reason that they're losing credibility. Well, then how did they lose credibility with me? If I got it from me. Well, I got it from someone else. I got the idea from someone else. So it wasn't just the fact that they kept lying and losing credibility in my eyes. It was because someone else convinced me of it. It can't be both. I suppose it can't be true, and then someone else makes you aware of it. Could it be that? No, not if it's inconvenient. So, yeah, UBI. I can touch briefly. Let me just see our time. 10. So we've been about an hour and 10. I had another question. And I will give it less time. This one's from Peter Jones. This was from July 25th, actually. I'm getting to it now. I don't know if you'll be able to hear it. Maybe I'll find him, get it to him. From a seminar I did with Matt Arrett a couple weekends ago. And he goes, "Hi, Joaquin. I enjoyed your educational today. It's good to hear you live. I will take you up on the follow-up by email, mainly because I wasn't able to get my question in the way I wanted, which was about the institutionalization of the of a Russian replacement for the euthanized Nuremberg rules, but the question of real interests are shaped by the discussion. I'm a U.S. citizen who moved to Canada around 2006-2009 during the Bush Wars on Terror and the election fraud, and I'm a lifelong peace activist and Toronto chair of World Beyond War. As a grad school professor at OCADU, I hosted their 2018 Design for Peace conference. Now Canada is worse than the U.S. and we're thinking of returning because I believe one makes a bigger difference in your own country than anywhere as an expat. Skin in the game and there's nowhere to hide now. The question is related to fifth generation warfare and the NATO emphasis on the cognitive domain. Cognitive warfare is necessarily against one's own people. It is not, but it can be. So it is sufficient to say that it is used. It's sufficient in, for what you're saying to talk about being used on its own people, though. To keep us entranced while the Ukraine money is laundered by our tax-funded oligarchs. My concept is fifth-generation peace. I believe the peace movement needs to fight back on the same domain and to mobilize in the evolving information battlefield. I also think this is why younger people are not drawn to the anti-war movement. They inherently recognize that protests and marches don't do much against empire, but they also badly informed about war and its alternatives. So the question is, what advice do you have for revitalizing the U.S. peace movement to organize against cognitive warfare? What would you do? And would you be interested in being one of our panels? Oh, thank you for the invitation. I should respond ASAP for the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute and for talking about peace in a world beyond war. Thank you, Peter Hayward Jones. I would say that, in advertising and stuff like that, you talk about hype and anything next generation. And the reality is that what you have right now, the state of things in warfare, is fourth generation. And the problem is that definitions about what fourth generation is are somewhat limited. I mean, but broadly, if you understand that the cognitive domain elements and information, we're talking about information war, but even not information war, but just actually attacking the cognitive attacks. In other words, like, remember what adbusters used to talk about with SSRI, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and other antidepressants? Remember adbusters? And they would talk about this domain of the elites, you know, class struggle or the war of the elites against the deplorables, against the expendables, the useless eaters, us, we, the people, les misérables. They actually have this agenda on the cognitive domain, and that's all within the rubric of fourth generation warfare. So I always have a thing against hype and marketing gimmicks, and anything fifth generation right now is a marketing gimmick. When you're talking about the fifth generation, F-35 is actually at best 4.25 generation. It's really a fourth generation multi-role. I mean, they just need it for too many purposes. It was like a Homer Simpson project. Like, we need a jet that's a fighter and an attack plane that can lift off on a runway or land like on a carrier directly. We need it to be able to achieve this speed and fly this type of sorties, but then also you're going to have to redesign and retrofit everything from refueling midair. You're going to, because that's not compatible backwards. You're going to have to refit. You're going to have to make new, you know, aircraft carriers if you're going to use this as naval aircraft carriers, and you're going to have to redesign the whole services of aircraft carriers, despite the fact that we live in an age where Iran with one missile. In talking about baseball, and is it a pitching game or a hitting game? We live at a time when a regional hegemon can eliminate the global hegemonic navy using the weaponry of a regional hegemon. Basically, surface-to-surface and surface-to-air missiles can be directed at a carrier and sink it at this stage of the game with the accuracy and the remote control with the cameras on the missile and everything, and the guy toggling it like a remote, like a video game, and eliminate aircraft carriers. So the game's changed a lot. So a lot of things are dumb. And yet there's this marketing impetus to keep saying that something is fifth generation. And it's just not fifth generation, okay? Just like, it's kind of the, it's on almost like the reversal of with Jeremy Rifkin talking about the third industrial revolution is coming, denying that the third industrial revolution has been here, because he's trying to define the third industrial revolution on the assumption that the fuels from the earth are fossil fuels, and that they're limited, and that they're too expensive, and that there are problems going forward, and that means that they are more abundant. We went through that whole argument. What's so wrong with it? Statements, positive statements of fact, just nonsense. And that's how, just to understand. So I think that we should, you know, that young people who are interested in peace and are motivated by the subject of war, generally speaking, do not need to be promoting these things among other young people. I mean, in other words, they can, but they shouldn't track their success on their ability to do that. You see what I mean? But the peace movement, one of the main reasons, Dr. Jones, that the peace movement is unappealing to young people, less appealing than it was, let's say, two or three generations ago, in the 60s and 70s, is because that peace movement arose out of a high point on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where people feel that their own issues of life are relatively stable, looking good, forward moving, and now they're in the position to now look at problems that don't really immediately affect them. We're talking about in the past. I mean, Vietnam wasn't going to in any way win the war to the extent that now they're landing boats on New York shores. So that, you see what I'm saying? So it wasn't a life or death struggle. And this was at a time when living conditions and working conditions were still improving. Houses were affordable. People were raising whole families at middle class incomes, having working class jobs, one parent. So I think what's really critically missing is not that we find the right buzzword and keeping up with generation inflation, you know, because honestly, we live, cognitive warfare is all fourth generation warfare. The problem is that you have an industry that, like in any industry, promotes novelty. The concept or the eyes that you catch and the ears that perk up when you talk about novelty are always too much of an incentive, right, not to be straight with where you really are at. And we're really at fourth generation warfare. I mean, look at the war in Ukraine. It's actually on the ground. Russia's using second generation warfare. So the idea that as the times change, that the generations are, yeah, there's a correlation, but you can see that in Syria, Russia was using a lot of third generation on the ground, but in Ukraine, they're using second generation. That's when you attrit by artillery at a distance, and then you send in the troops to occupy a position that's already been decimated by artillery. That's what the Russians are doing. You get very low casualties that way. You might have like one casualty per 30, you know, doing a sweep or cleanup or something. And I think that the issues that affect young people are money and work. And only secondarily, because of the arrangement of this empire, you could actually argue that there could be an empire that had a real trickle down economics. Then in the interest of money and work, you might be in favor of wars. I'm just saying. But in reality, how things are, it's not that way. It hasn't been that way. So I would look at the peace movement as an independent movement is limited. And what I would do is what I am doing, right? I talk about many issues and I connect it to my own ethos, which prefers peace. But I also understand the violence of our lived lives, and I understand the violence that gives shape and lends even meaning. And I understand the inherent violence of existence, and I understand that the world is kind of a state of war in many ways, of the war of all against all, and this kind of idea of a state in nature. Yes, there's cooperation, like Kropotkin proposed, mutual aid. Yes, you have animals help each other, and then animals also eat each other. So I'm looking at human solutions. Peace is often the outcome, but sometimes it's war, you see. And what I would do is what I am doing is this. I would love to be on one of your panels, and I think that the issue of youth in the peace movement is such that, you know, people don't have time or interest when they themselves are unemployed and hungry. So I think that, and that's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. People right now are focusing on their own issues of life, of like caloric necessities and shelter. Okay, those are the actual issues young people face right now. And obviously mobilizing them around those existing problems are going against the power elite pursuing war. So you're going to curtail the power to make war by curtailing their power. But an unemployed person, young person, who's really trying and is looking at the problems in their life, a war somewhere else in the world isn't high up on that list of things they must confront to survive. And I think that's the very big difference. It's not, see, there's, it's not that, you know, you're right that young people recognize that protests and marches don't do much against empire, but I think that people saw that was also true in the past, that protests and marches don't do much. So this was more of a cathartic expression, and it also expressed many other things, and they also serve as a social, you know, function as well, and a show of something. And I think that peace is not peace as an abstract, as a goal, is not something that is interesting to people, because many people right now are in such position that they, if they were offered to do violence in order to eat, they would. So that's, I think, where the terrain has to be at. Anyway, I really appreciate the invitation, the letter. That's just to the public. I'll write you back. You're probably not listening, but I'll write you back on this, and I appreciate it. That's been me getting into... that's me getting into my questions. Thanks for joining us today. Kind of shorter, I hope. And this will be up on the drive very soon. All right. This has been Joaquin, and I'm out. Peace.